Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Live Fundraising Success webinar, Data is Your Friend, sponsored by CDS Global. I'm Margaret Battistelli-Gardner, Editor-in-Chief of Fundraising Success and the host of today's event. Usually, I'm the moderator for these webinars, but today, I happily turn over the reins to our special guest moderator, Ellen Cobb Church. More about her and our other guests in a minute. Today, our panel is taking on the topic of data. Stop rolling your eyes. You're here for a reason. And sure, for many people, gathering and analyzing statistics isn't the most fun part of fundraising, but others just love it. And it's essential. So it's a good thing the rest of us have that second group and today's guests to guide us in the all-important area of data capture. This session pulls together some real data champs to help you figure out the best ways to gather that data and what to do with it. But before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. Excuse me. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the help widget at the bottom of the console, marked with a question mark, or let us know via the ask a question box. And I should warn you that every time I say widget, I giggle, so I try not to, but bear with me. You can also use the ask a question box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions during the session and at the end of it and at the end of the hour. You can send them in at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets and bells and whistles on the console. And speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on this console do and how you can customize your experience today. So, on to the panel. Our moderator today is Ellen Cobb Church, CEO of Craver, Matthew Smith. And today's panelists consist of Laura Thornton, Jennifer Mercer, who is filling in for Ben Miller, who couldn't be with us today. Get well quick, Ben. And Tim Daugherty. Ellen, why don't you take over and make the more formal introductions?
Sure, my pleasure. Laura, I'd like to start with you, and perhaps you could just give us a little quick synopsis of what you do at Child Fund and why you love data.
Oh, you're too kind. I'm Laura Thornton. I'm actually in a dual role here at Child Fund. I'm the director of marketing, and I'm also the director of analytics and CRM. So today I'm going to be talking to you with my analytics and CRM hat, but I work on our acquisition campaigns, our cultivation campaigns, and then obviously building our CRM and data strategy.
Thanks. And unfortunately, Ben is not with us today, but my partner, Jen Mercer, is filling in for him. So, Jen, could you just speak a little bit about why you're here today?
Absolutely. I'd love to. Thank you, Ellen. My name is Jen Mercer. I am Principal and Executive Vice President at CMS. I do love data. I hope that I can be as interesting and exciting as Ben would have been today, but I did brush up a little bit with him prior, so hopefully I'll have some good information to share with you all.
And lastly, but certainly not least, one of my favorite data friends, Tim Daugherty at Habitat for Humanity International. Tim?
Thanks, Ellen. Yes, my name is Tim Daugherty. I'm the Deputy Director at Habitat for Humanity International, in charge of all of our direct marketing functions, including direct mail, online fundraising, and telemarketing. And yes, been known to drive our partners crazy with data requests to figure out how we can improve our fundraising performance. So thanks for having me here today.
And thanks to all of you for joining us. Data is sometimes part of fundraising that inhibits a lot of people. People are afraid of it. You think that you can't really understand it if you're working on the other side of the table. But truly, it's something that really should be all of our friends, and all of us should know how to use it, when to use it, and what parts of it to use. And so this panel today is going to discuss different things about data and how you can use it, whether you're a large organization or a small organization, to help your fundraising program. So we're going to start off with Laura.
Great. I'm going to talk to you first about building your data and what are all the different ways you might be able to access data or find different places to gather data from both a marketing perspective, a fundraising perspective, and also a philanthropy or development perspective. So I want to begin with the end in mind and talk about CRM. We're all doing this so that we can build lifetime value or increase fundraising within our database. But for us here at Child Fund, we define CRM, or we also call it DRM, donor relationship management, that we're trying to acquire new donors, then we're trying to increase their giving, but also increase their giving type and have them work into work with giving to us in multiple products. We want to keep them active and obviously retain them, move them up the donor loyalty pyramid, and ultimately increase their lifetime value. But to do all of this, we need a lot of data. From the marketing perspective, the traditional means of building the marketing process is to start with awareness of your brand, to understanding, to interest, and desire. And I just put this down here to think through all of the different channels that we use and how we build our brands. But there's also an opportunity there to collect data. Looking at it from the development process, for us it's looking at first bringing in new sponsors, one-time donors, having them give an extra contribution, then having them look at planned giving opportunities, major gift opportunities, and then ultimately bequest opportunities. And each point along the way, again, is another opportunity for us to collect and use data. When we bring this together and look at it from the research process, we've got all of the different channels that we use for our marketing and fundraising. We also have the different types of research that we might do, qualitative, which might be focus groups, or from a philanthropy perspective, our one-to-one meetings that we have with our donors, to quantitative, building predictive models, and then we have the different ways that we might target donors. So the orange on the side is broad reach, targeted, and impersonal, and each one of those has a different layer of data that we use. Bringing that together, we have three types of data that we look at here at Child Fund. First, we have our contact data, secondly, our marketing data, and then thirdly, our development data. And I'm going to walk through each one of these and explain a little bit about the different data types and how we approach determining what we want to collect and which things we want to just be fanatical about having it be the best that it can be. From contact data, it seems very basic, being able to have the best names and addresses on your database, but it's something that is really an endurance test. So we're continually having to make sure that we're aware of postal processes, everything is CAF certified, that we're doing NCOA, but with different types of data, we're also having to make sure that we're keeping our email addresses up to date, our telemarketing, our phone numbers up to date, and there being so many different ways to do that, we have to have a pretty robust process of doing different appends. Under name, I just specified two that seem very basic but really catch us all the time from a data collection standpoint into a personalization standpoint. Title on our databases, we have some old systems here where we might have hundreds of different titles, and we're often looking at whether we make something an optional requirement online or through different input methods or if it's something that's mandatory. And often we say that it's something that's optional, but not having title on a contact record starts to matter when you start to contact people in either telefundraising or through direct mail. So it's just one that we spend a lot of time, even with people who come in through the web, to be able to go back in and see that we can infer or collect title from them in another way so that we can have better personalization. The same thing with first name. It might not be something that where you have to make sure that the quality of that is as good as it can be, because it's one of the fields that we use a lot in email personalization. So there's two fields right there which seem very basic, but they're sort of a gotcha if you're not working on making them be the best that they can be when you start to do direct mail or fundraising.
Laura, if I could just interrupt here just for a moment, could you please explain to folks what CAS and NCOA are, in case we have some listeners that maybe aren't as familiar with those terms as others?
Oh, sure. CAS certification is just it's actually software or an update that we have here internally that's used for postal processing. What it means, if you have an address that is CAS certified, it just means that the address that you have theoretically is something within the postal system that it can actually be delivered. It doesn't mean that you've got the right address for the right person, but it just means it's in a format that can be delivered. We process everything that comes into our system automatically goes through that. You have the ability to override it if there's something that you know that's special, or if you have a Vanity City, we have a few here in the Richmond area where somebody's address might say that they would be considered in the city of Henrico, but they really want to make sure all of their mail is always delivered to Richmond. So you can override it, and it would still be delivered. But it's just a basic nuts and bolts thing that you should make sure that you're doing with all of your addresses that are on your database. NCOA, on the other hand, is looking back at, so once you collect the addresses on your database, people move. And so that's the National Change of Address file. And what we do is we send our data out every 2 months and have a full refresh on our whole file that updates everyone who has moved and inputs the new addresses on there, and then gives us all of the certifications that we can use with all of our agencies. So whenever we pull a file to use for our monthly mailings or our appeals, anytime throughout that time period, we've got that certification that we can send to the post office so they don't run it through the same process again, and we end up re-NCOAing the file and not having it come back into our main database. With email and telemarketing, there's similar processes, but as you can imagine, it's even though those collecting that data and having those updates is something that's available, it's not something that has as long of a history of working as necessarily those that are in postal processing. So almost with our database here, we had email addresses, and we actually had to wait a while for us to have enough email addresses that are not deliverable for us to start looking at some of the ECOA updates. But even then, you have to kind of be careful of making sure that you really have the new address and that you're almost opting them in again. The same with phones. Again, that keeps changing, and so we just have to do an extra step to make sure that it's the quality of data that we want. The CAS and the NCA is just a lot more straightforward. Other types of contact data that we collect are preference data, so communications preferences. If you have a donor that says that they'd like to receive more information from one particular channel, you can have those flags in your database. We also keep program preference data, and that is just for us having flags for if a person likes to receive more information about a certain region, or for us, it's that they happen to sponsor more children in a certain country. That gives us a good indicator of how we might want to alter our fundraising. And those are all things that you have internally. It's not necessarily going out and doing an append. We keep engagement flags, and for us, it might be someone who's attended a reception or someone who's called in and says they want to travel to the field and visit with someone or visit their sponsored child. So we flag all of that in the database so that we've got a good idea of those sponsors or supporters who are really engaged with us, and we might want to do different things to them or do personalization to them in a different way. And then we have all of the behavioral RFM data, so all of the stuff that you have within your donation or transaction history. That's when was the last gift, the largest gift, the lifetime giving. For us, it's where they sponsored children, which funds might they have given to the last time. We take all of that data, and we create a lot of additional flags or fields, and those just help us for when we get ready to do an actual appeal or fundraising campaign that they're easy to get to. You don't have to go back into the whole database and compute different things. And then the last thing that is always amazing to me is I call it the renegade spreadsheets or the non-linked databases, and that's often the best information, and it sits throughout your organization. It's how do you find those tools or things that other people have that give you some good engagement or flags or behavioral information and come up with a way to be able to code that and bring that into the database. Some of the best data has been in there. We've had different request spreadsheets sitting out there. We have a whole database that gives us information about when our sponsors write to their sponsored children, and for us that's the ultimate engagement piece, so we know that sponsors have taken an action. So it's how do you bring all of that, but it's not connected to our main database. So in all of these, it's can you find a way to find out what those extra things are, and maybe it's once a quarter you create a link so that you can bring that data into your fundraising. For marketing data, I just highlighted a few. There's multiple data elements that you can append to your database, but age, income, length of residence, and homeowner are ones that we often find are the most predictive of future behavior, or ones that we like to be able to move forward to our analysts to interpret, and ones that we can also use one-off for other types of analysis. So if we have age on the file, we might do some different things with planned giving. Same with income. Length of residence also helps us with planned giving. And then homeowner, renter, that's just another one that helps us understand the segmentation of who's on our database. All of these help to build a profile, but if you are only able to choose a few or even want to start with one, it just gives you a nice place to be able to start to what would be the most important element to add. Other types of marketing data that we've had on our database, different types of geodemographic codes. So we've often had PRISM is one that is used a lot in other industries. They're model clusters. It's based upon ZIP plus 4 and other types of psychographic data, but they've got great names, and sometimes what we use them for is to even help our philanthropy or development officers know if we've given them another group of prospects. It allows them to get their head around what might these people be like. It's not exactly what the people will be like when they have their one-to-one meeting, but they have a lot of fun looking at the different groups. Some of them, Blue Blood Estates, Money and Brains, those are ones that we have in the Northeast Corridor, Kids in Cul-de-Sacs or Big Fish, Small Pond in some of our smaller markets. Just another way for us if we want to go out and do some different middle donor strategies or pull people in, that you can have those codes out there, and it can be a shortcut to creating some good campaigns. There's a geographic code, a DMA code, that's a designated market area code. We use that for our television media buying. So we're often looking at other markets and what might a market look like and do we want to have commercials there. But we've also found that it's a really nice thing to have when you're doing your working with development. So I can go out and say, okay, I want to pull everyone in the St. Louis area, and instead of going through massive amounts of zip code books or SCF tables, we can say, let's just pull the St. Louis area. Let's look at the donors in that area, and are there some different trends that we see there? Are there people that we might be able to have work with us on a volunteer event? Are there some that need to move to our middle donor program or a major donor program? It's just a quick way to get to different pieces of data. Psychographic data is lifestyle propensity data. Sometimes you'll see that come up if someone's working with you on a predictive model. It might be somebody who's more likely to have a pet or a bird or a cat, or they like to read books. Those are really interesting data elements when you're looking at segmentation. They're not as useful to us when we're actually doing specific types of campaigns, but again, it's one more element if we're trying to really talk about what the donor is like or what a certain segment is like. And then the big piece of data that is really close to behavioral that we spend some time tracking is our multi-channel data. So we keep track of people who respond to appeals, obviously, but also those that don't respond, more so in our digital area. With digital data, we've also got who logged into the website, who clicked on each piece of email, and we try to take some of those data elements and, again, make them more of counters than one-offs so that it's not so much data that you can't get your head around, well, if I know that they didn't open the email 50 times, but these other 4 times they did, you know, that's a little bit harder to get your head around versus what types of emails they might be opening. Is it an update versus an appeal? Is it your newsletter? What are some ways to look at that? And then acquisition tracking, we spend a lot of time coding that. And for us, it's what channel did a donor come to us from the first time that they gave to us? And really being able to be as granular about it as we can. So if they came to us through DRTV, we want to know what commercial they were watching, what station they were on. If they came to us through digital, we've actually broken digital out to many sub-channels. So we want to know whether it was from mobile. We want to know whether it was from banner, a different type of banner ad. Did it come in through YouTube, Google, Yahoo, whatever type of digital strategy that we're doing. If we're working with face-to-face, we want to know which market they were in, which product they originally came in on. If they're coming to us from direct response for direct mail, we want to know which list they were on and which product they came in on. So we spend a lot of time coding that first touch so that we can build strong cases for our acquisition efforts and also really look at the complete donor from an ROI perspective. If the other one would be live events, if they're working on an artist program, we want to know which band they went to see, and we'll also track, if we can, which market they were in so we can see how markets do and also how different musicians or artists are performing. And the last piece of data that we have is the development data. And this is really interesting to me because we traditionally bring in data from a fundraising or our marketing perspective and things that we're doing from acquisition or cultivation. But over on the other side of the house, our prospect research group is using just as much data. And we're finding that there's so many ways that we can go back and forth with using similar data elements and really creating a complete picture of our donors. So for us, it's, you know, visits and contact reports. Is there anything within how a philanthropy officer is reporting out on a visit that is something that is appropriate to be codable or that they can add in as a data element to help us with further campaigns? There's multiple screening, whether you're working with something, someone like a Target Analytics or a Wealth Engine or Black Thought, any of them that can go in and build some coding or propensity scores, or if they're actual data elements that the researchers are working on and also doing some inclination or propensity scores. The other opportunity is that they're going to be, the development officers are going to be able to collect more name and address data. So that will give you the ability to create or really populate additional fields with multiple address layers, name preferences, or even more preference data. So it gives you a one-to-one place to verify some of your other data elements. I wouldn't bring all of these up, but if you have a strong middle donor strategy, often we're creating mail files that might be, you know, 1,200 to 2,000 people, and we actually will spend a lot of time either doing some digital printing or making sure the elements are very much customized. And if you can really have your fundraising team helping you code or get information to come back in, it will help you be able to have even better campaigns. So I know that that's a lot of data, so I wanted to put in here on my where do you start. I think it's really going through those three different types of data and looking at your system to make sure you've got the best contact data that you've got, because you've got to make sure that all of your efforts actually get to the person, get to your recipients, so that they have the opportunity to hear about your amazing campaign. So I put in here contact data for personalization, just making sure that you really spend some time on that. And it might seem like you're ready to move on to the next piece or do this other type of data, which would be really interesting, but just don't have that be at the expense of having fantastic deliverability. Again, the good address, postal, and email data. And then look at, you'll start to get feedback from if you start to do some modeling or looking at some trending or building some propensity scores for anything on your database. It's find out which fields tend to be the most predictive of future behavior. And once you really know what the key elements are, make sure that those are the ones that you spend the most time making sure you collect and that they're coded right. And those are the ones you really put on there. You fight the good fight, making sure that those are the ones where if somebody decides they're going to restructure or build a different table, do something different in your database, that those are things that you really make sure you get them the way that you want them to be. Examples would be length of time of giving or types of programs that they give to. And then, of course, once you've got the basics all down, make sure you test new data elements for use and strategy. So if you have an idea and you think that there might be some new ways to collect data, think about how you would use that, because if you have small penetration on a data element, if your targeting is good or if it's a great middle donor strategy, then go for it. But if your propensity or your penetration is going to be really small and you're not sure how you're going to use it, everyone's just going to be upset and you're going to spend a lot of time doing data entry and not actually get to the point of using it. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to the analysts. Hopefully we built a big, robust, beautiful data set, and now we're going to be pushing it along.
Thanks, Laura. And we will be taking questions at the end. And also, just so you know, this will be available on demand for 90 days starting tomorrow. So for those of you who would like to download the presentation, you'll be able to do so. Thank you. And Jen, you're next.
Thank you, Ellen. Thank you, Laura, also. So Laura has given a lot of great information about some of the data out there that can be collected, but I'm going to talk a little bit about what we can do with the data once we have it. First, I just want to
to mention that big data is widely growing. And what big data means is almost too much data, more than anyone can process on their own, and more of it is available. In Nate Silver's book, he says half of the world's data has become available just in the past year, which is almost unreal. It's virtually impossible for a group to process all of this data internally. And even though there is so much available, what's really important is to know what data is critical and what data is actionable. So a good analyst is like a good air traffic controller. You have to be able to decipher what is important. So what you're seeing here is radar, much like what an air traffic controller would see on his screen. So you have to see what data is available and how to sort through it. For example, an air traffic controller, there's a lot of information available, but they're able to hone in on what's important, like the speed of the plane, the distance from the runway, and the other air traffic in the area, much like a good analyst is able to as well. So here we're showing an example of an acquisition test that we did. And you can see that in basic reporting, the test seemed to perform really well. We received more new donors, more revenue, and more net. But it didn't win on ROI because of the cost of the package. So we took it a step deeper to see what the true winner of the test would really be. So we looked at subsequent giving, and you can see that the test still had more revenue. The percentage giving a second gift was lower, but again, it did generate more revenue per quantity, and so the value of the donors was not sacrificed with the test. The analysis of the data is not just showing you the metrics, but being able to evaluate the trade-offs. We are big believers in customized predictive models also that we've perfected for our clients, but Tim is going to talk a little bit about this more in his section. We use CHADE analysis because we want to find things that aren't showing up in other reports. An analysis that we perform. Tim may remember that we did a great analysis after Hurricane Katrina with Habitat, but the analysis that you're seeing here is for another client. And we saw some unique things here too. Most people think that people with higher HPCs or gift amounts are better donors. But what this is showing in that first node 4 box that's called out is that 54% of people in the $49 to $60 group gave a gift. And when you compare that to node 5, you see that 50.9% of people in the $60 to $99 group made a gift. Compared to node 6, where 55.9% of donors in the $99 to $120 range gave a gift. So this arms us with info to look at these donor groups in different ways, which may affect the way that we do our segmentation, the way that we do selects. And here we see that it's not necessarily the folks with the higher HPCs that are better donors, but this lower dollar group of $49 to $60 donors are making more gifts than the $60 to $99 donors. So this can be used in a lot of different ways. This is just an example of chain analysis that we've done. This is an analysis that shows a 5-year net lifetime value of new donors. And this is one of the tools we use to evaluate investment options and how it works. So here, we've shown that if you mail an additional 2.5 million pieces, that we can raise an additional $1 million over 5 years. Subsequently, if we mail an additional 5 million pieces, it goes up to 1.5 million. But the table also shows
that with 10 million additional pieces, we are steady at 1.5 million net, which shows, in this case, the more you mail, the less responsive lists you're getting, you're spending more money to raise the same amount of dollars. So finally, there's a host of people out there trying to sell you information and data, but unless you can show the significance and they can provide you with an actual actionable outcome, it's likely not worth the effort. As you all know, I'm filling in for Ben Miller today, and on Ben's soapbox, he's a firm believer that you must understand the math behind the data. And at our agency, Ben and other analysts are the ones explaining the analysis to our clients. We can stand behind it. You can't predict what the data and analysis will tell you, but you should always get something in return, or it's not worth it. And one of the other things in Nate Silver's book that I mentioned before, he mentions that if someone tells you that this is what the computer tells us, that means that there's no human thinking going into it. This is my basic point with this last slide, that analysis should come with actionable outcomes. And with that being said, I'm going to hand over to Tim.
Thank you, Jen. I appreciate that. So I wanted to go through some examples of things that we've done here at Habitat and some things that other organizations have done. After you've collected all the data, you've analyzed it, well, now what do you do with it? And there's probably a million things that are going through folks' minds, but there's two basically that I wanted to talk through today. One is use data in a way that lets your constituents know that you know who they are. When you do this in messaging, they tend to be more responsive when you do that. And then the second thing that I would like to cover today is finding diamonds in the rough, which both Laura and Jen alluded to with regard to modeling and wealth overlays and such. And I'll go through examples of both of those. So commercial entities do this all the time, right? So let's start with letting donors or customers know you know who they are. So recently I was on Amazon.com and I was shopping for a Bluetooth speaker to use with my phone, and I looked at this one. It was good price, seemed to have good ratings, and that was great, but I didn't buy it right away. So the next day I decided to hop over to start planning a family vacation on a vacation rental by owner, and they remarketed me. So you can see the very same product that I looked at on Amazon the day before was pushed to me. They actually had a slide of two or three products that were all Bluetooth speakers, and were pushing that product. So they knew that I came and looked at this, and they leveraged that data in a way to find me elsewhere on the web and market their products back to me. There's several nonprofits who leverage remarketing well, and two that really come to mind who do this well and in a big way are World Vision and American Cancer Society. Another example in the commercial world that I'd like to share with, and they take it to a whole new level, is Netflix. So anybody who uses this, you probably are familiar with this screen. You watch a movie, right, and they ask you to rate it. And based on that rating, they'll then take that data and produce a list of movies that they think you might be interested in. I apparently was on a bit of a history kick lately based on the queue that I have, but you'll see that the top 10 for Tim was pointed out in that. So they use a very sophisticated predictive model that's the engine for this functionality. And I was talking to Ben about this a little while ago, and he mentioned that there was a contest recently that Netflix ran to see if anyone could beat their predictive model. The contest had $1 million prize. So that just speaks to the value that they put on data and the resources that they're willing to put behind it. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't have the dollars that Netflix or Amazon has to take on big data projects. So now what? Well, use the data that you know and that you do have. And Laura talked about a lot of these. Did they donate recently or not? I've got a Habitat example I'll share with you in just a few minutes with this. Did they donate to, and I put it in quotes, this campaign last year? So if you have a pillar campaign year end or a match, something along those lines, actually referring back to that particular gift you gave to this campaign last year, we've shown improved response and average gifts and such. They increased their giving recently. You might want to consider thresholds for this, but say, for instance, they increased their giving by 50% for certain dollar levels of donors. Put them in some form of calling program. Go ahead and fast-track them into a major gift portfolio, those types of things. They may have attended an event, or as Laura mentioned, they wrote to their sponsored child or they volunteered. We know that multiple touch points often indicate higher value donors. They expressed a particular interest. Animal organizations do this a lot. So ASPCA or Humane Society and others will collect interest on, you know, whether or not people like dogs or cats or bears or whatnot, and use that to push content to them appropriately to their interests. Or they donated at particular times of year. So you might see patterns in giving. Maybe people have some seasonality to their giving, so you might want to focus your interactions in that season of giving and maybe dial them back in those off seasons. And so this could not only help with letting people know you know who they are, but could help cost saves on the cost side for your organization and increase efficiency. And I apologize. I don't think I pushed that slide to you initially. So I wanted to go through an example that Habitat did recently. And we had a very simple but powerful example. We took our donors who had given us $1,000, it's either a single gift or cumulatively over the course of a year. And but they had recently lapsed, so they hadn't given to us in somewhere between 13 and 24 months. So we kind of scooped up this group of donors, and we sent them a cultivation piece. And our goal was to get them to reactivate and increase response to subsequent gifts. And I'll show you a sample of the package here. It was pretty simple. There was an outer envelope, a pretty simple, it's faux handwritten note that basically says that they wanted to thank, we wanted to thank those donors for their extraordinary past giving, but that we hadn't heard from them in a little while and that we hope that we can count on their help again soon. So very simple, nothing sophisticated. And what we found initially, and this speaks to what both Laura and Jen were talking about as well, is that the response to that particular package wasn't that great. But what we did is we tracked performance of those donors over time. And what we found when we did that over the course of a year is that we actually had a 34% higher reactivation rate and a 46% higher average gift, which is huge because these are $1,000-plus donors, a very profitable segment of our database. So with this information and data in hand, we decided to roll this out into a monthly program, and are doing this on an ongoing basis. So another way to use data is to find those high-value donors that might not quite be giving to you at the level that they're capable of. These are sort of finding the diamonds in the rough. And there's some behavioral data that might point to higher value donors, and those might be that they gave a relatively large initial gift. I've talked to analysts from multiple organizations, including Target Analytics, who have said the biggest predictor of future value is the size of that initial gift. So that's a huge data point. Or they may have upgraded significantly recently. We touched on that a little bit earlier. But sometimes you need to dig a little deeper, and that's where models come in, which is the last point here, which is exactly what we did here at Habitat. So what we did is we took a pool of 0 to 60-month donors, and we looked at several things with regard to wealth screening and data modeling. We looked at target gift range, how much can they give to us on an annual basis? How likely are they to give a major gift or a mid-level gift? What do their liquid financial assets look like? So this is sort of cash on hand. What is really their capacity? Have they given to other organizations, like-minded organizations that might indicate a propensity to give more to your organization? And then for those that really rose to the top, we went to our research team and said, give us some comprehensive wealth identification based on these donors. Well, the results were huge for us. They did a really great job of helping us build out portfolios for our major gift officers. So what we found were 19,126 donors in that group of 0 to 60 months that had the capacity to give $5,000 or more. And within that, there were 1,273 donors capable of giving 10 to 25, 187, 25 to 50, and 19 that were able to give 50,000 more. These were all donors that we had not identified previously by other means. So this just speaks to the power of using the data that we had at hand, appending those external sources of data, and using modeling to identify those. So I hope this gives you at least a sense of the types of ways that we use modeling and data to improve our fundraising performance here at Habitat. And with that, I will hand things back to Ellen for a question session.
Thanks, Tim. One thing that I would like to do, we're getting a lot of questions, and I really appreciate everyone that is participating by submitting questions, and we'll try to get most of them covered if we can, is to ask Laura and Jen and Tim if they could just give us quickly, starting with Laura, what you think the top two takeaways from your portion of the presentation have been, so that we can help people to zone in on what you think the top two areas are that they should walk away with. Laura?
Sure. I think for me, the first one is making sure that you spend the time needed on the first area, the contact data. There's lots of other data elements to use, but have good processes around the contact data. The second would be looking at all of the different types of elements, and I think it was later said, almost by Ben's presentation as well, is prioritize what you want to do next in terms of data collection with the things that you think are most predictive of being able to, the variables most predictive for your strategy for how to raise more money. So there's a lot of things that are interesting out there, but if you really think through what your strategy is going to be, then make sure you match those data elements to them.
Great, thank you. Jen?
I would say my two takeaways are, even though there is a lot of data available, make sure that you are using what's actionable. So it's important to know what the most critical pieces of the data that you're utilizing are so that you can actually take actionable steps to put good strategies into place. And also, make sure that you understand the math behind the data. Make sure that it's data that you can stand behind. And Tim, how about you?
I think both Laura and Jen hit the nail on the head, but where I would come from is keep it simple. You can quickly get overwhelmed with the amount of data that's available to you. Really keying in on two things, three things. What can I collect? What's actionable? And what do I have the capacity to actually, you might be able to come up with an action plan, but if you don't have the staff or the technology or the infrastructure to be able to pull it off, don't start there. So, again, keep it simple with an eye on what you can actually accomplish once you've collected and analyzed data.
Thanks, Tim. We're getting a lot of questions that I'm going to kind of group together because I think they have to do with how we treat our donors and what the donor experiences with us based on the type of information that we have about the donor and how we use it. So I was hoping that the three of you could talk a little bit about what you think the importance of having the right name or the right title, or how do you handle data knowing that it's not going to be 100% correct on everyone so that the donors still feel like they're having a good experience with you? And also, do you have any problems with donors maybe feeling like you might know too much about them, or that how you're gathering information that you're not asking the donor specifically for, so that you can use that to further your fundraising program and deeper develop your relationship with your donor. And Netflix is a good example, Tim, because I had to chuckle to myself, because if anyone out there who is participating in the webinar has teenagers or perhaps young adults living with you, you are sometimes probably as surprised as I am when you see that what they're suggesting for you is truly not meant for you but for the other people in your house.
Yeah, I watch more VeggieTales than I would like to admit alongside of my children, so you're exactly right. But I'll take a stab at fielding that. You're exactly right. You can leverage some of this data that you know about folks to come back to them with appropriate levels of asks or those types of things, going back to the modeling thing that I was showing earlier. But anything that they give you, So they gave to a campaign that was about something that happened in Africa. Well, they handed you that information, and it is certainly fair game to go back to them with information regard to that specific geographic area as a result, or they sponsored a child in that area of the world. All of those things are certainly points that are leverageable, and I think in some cases an expectation out of our donors. They know that they've interacted with you this way, and they don't necessarily want to hear about Asia in the example that I was giving. They expect you to communicate with them that way. So, again, if it's handed to you from the donor, leverage it as much as you can. But, yes, be careful with that you acquire from third parties.
And I would just add to what Tim is saying, the way that your donors are communicating with you is also another thing that they're telling you. Whether people are only giving through the mail, or you know, if they're on your email list and you're able to phone them and they're giving through the mail, and they're giving through all three methods, then that tells you something as well. So keep that in mind as you target your campaigns also.
The only thing I would add with the data collection is the first time you look at your database or you look at some of your name and address data, really look at it, you're gonna see things that you don't want to see. It's going to be a mess. You might be pleasantly surprised, but you're going to see things like we had in suffixes, everybody that had a junior had been double entered through data conversion, so junior. So we knew that all of our mail was going out, junior, senior, and we didn't know how long it had been going out. So you have to go, okay, we're going to fix the things that are in here and know that our mail will start looking better and we'll start to be that more personalized. So there will be a lot of data entry. There will be things that aren't necessarily a data pen, but you can just look at your data and go, gosh, you know, a little data entry, we can get these all cleaned up. Excel has become a great tool where if we pull stuff out and we see things, we can see things that we might want to change, and then we can go back into our main data system and do some data entry. There's a lot you can do from just looking at your data, but don't be upset the first time you see it. Know that whatever you do, you're going to be making things better for your donor, and hopefully they'll start to go, oh, look, you know, they got it right. For personal, when you get a lot of data in with third parties and different types of information, we always use it to try to be more relevant, but never, ever scary. So what we're trying to do is make sure we get the right piece of mail or the right offer or get the right ask amount, but never say something that would lead anyone to think that there's something going on that they would not be comfortable with. So we use it more for strategy and for some targeting, but never things that would be customized in a way that would not be a good donor experience.
Thank you. Some other questions that are popping up that seem to be of interest have to do with modeling. And so I was hoping that we could expand a little bit on what type of modeling that perhaps you've done at Habitat or Child Fund, how you've used that to maybe mail more efficiently, or and use that as a talking point for folks who are from smaller organizations so that they can perhaps learn how to take what you do at your larger organizations and apply it to their own work on a daily basis.
I can take a stab at that. So at Habitat, we've done several modeling exercises, but one of the things that I think is on the minds of a lot of nonprofits particularly those who have built models of single gift donors, meaning they give one gift at a time, not monthly, is how to build that monthly giving file. And so we're underway with doing modeling exactly along those lines. And there's two things that we're looking at. One is a true model, which goes out and gets, again, a lot of the data elements that Laura mentioned and builds that model based on that. But others are cooperative databases that a lot of organizations participate in. So if they are giving to another organization on a monthly basis, there's a high likelihood that they would do the same for you. There's some research out there that says, and don't quote me on the, I can't quote the exact number, but monthly givers tend to give to multiple organizations. They are not a one-and-done type of thing. So certainly some things to look at for organizations of all sizes, and particularly the cooperative type of data is something that's affordable and effective.
Thank you. Laura, do you have any experience with modeling that you would like to share?
Sure. I mean, we've used predictive models to score against retention, to do propensities for major gifts and middle gifts. We often use regression, but one of the things that we have found, and we even have a segmentation that's out there that is more trade-based, but we always overlay what we might see with a model or even specifically with some segmentation with some standard RFM data. That's your recency, frequency, monetary data. So just some of the most recent behaviors of how much someone has given to you or how often they give to you can be sort of put together as a hybrid with any type of segmentation to get good targeting for an appeal.
Thanks, Laura. One thing that's kind of come to mind for me as I've been looking at the questions and listening to you guys talk is that, you know, a lot of us, especially those that work at the nonprofit organizations themselves, have budgets that are tight, have staffing, you know, concerns, don't have a lot of people that they can spread the analysis out to. And so I was hoping that we could talk a little bit about when you're looking at how you're going to go about the next fiscal year or what your plans are, how do you incorporate how much time and energy and resources, both your own, maybe it's your agencies, maybe it's other outside sources, should be put on data and analytics. In the past decades ago, you know, it was all about creative, and we're not, you know, here to say that that's not an important piece of it, because it is. But more and more, we do all need to be focusing on analytics and having a lot of discussions about it amongst ourselves within organizations and across organizations. So I'd be interested in hearing how you think, you know, data should be part of your planning and how you're building your teams both internally and with your external partners.
I can take a stab at it. This is Laura. We're definitely dialing up analytics with more channels and just a, you know, the difficulty of fundraising in general. There needs to be better targeting, better information, more information about ROI, and just with more and more data that we figure that there's got to be, it really provides the nexus for how we're going to be able to implement all of the different channels and all of the programs for what we have. So we're really looking at a comprehensive analytical plan and data hygiene plan for this fiscal year, it being that both types of things are important, you know, being able to get stuff to donors now so that they have the opportunity to respond, but also to be able to make sure we get the best appeal, the best communication, the best opportunities in front of donors that's the most relevant to them. So we're really getting ready to dial it up more than we ever have.
And are you putting things in place so that you, to talk about, for instance, like what's your ROI on what you're spending? Do you have those kinds of questions coming internally, or are there things that maybe folks can take away as to why they can advocate internally for more money to be put into the analytics side of their budgets?
Absolutely. absolutely. More questions internally, but it all being really focused on, as an organization, for us to know where to invest the most resources in terms of fundraising. So the big question is, if we have a pool of dollars for fundraising, where should it best be allocated? And we're really looking at analytics to help us get there, for not only by channel, but also how to look at each donor that comes in and was that the right decision.
Great.
And I can give a couple of, for instances. I mean, you know, I remember the good old days when we used to make money in prospecting, and you know, those are long gone. And we're in a new normal. It's not going to get back to those days anytime soon. And so, this is a way to become more efficient. And that's the lens that I always sort of make the case internally for. So when you're looking at analytics projects, you do need to look at, well, how much money is it going to cost us to get there versus what the return is going to be. One thing that I would encourage folks to is not to take too short of a view. We've shown several examples where if you're expecting that return to be immediate, that may not be the case, but it is certainly going to put your organization in a better place 2, 3, 5 years from now. You're going to need to provide that sort of analysis to justify the cost of some of these analytics projects.
And we were talking earlier, and Tim, I think you also touched on some things that you were doing to help build portfolios for mid-level and major gift centers. And a question's popped up about moves management and how you're using analytics to help in that way, so that this is not just a direct response tool and analytics that we're talking about. It's something that's widespread and should be moving across the whole organization.
Absolutely. And this starts to cross the line of, you know, analytics versus reporting. But at Habitat, we've developed pretty comprehensive protocols for what are the triggers. Is there a trigger gift or a trigger interaction with a donor that should push someone to a portfolio? But we're also looking at, well, how do they perform once they're there? Are they answering the phone when we try to call them? Has a visit been scheduled within 3 to 6 months? And if the answer to those things are no, then we want to pull them back into the mechanism that they originated from. So we're trying to avoid hard and fast rules of a person hits a dollar threshold, whether that's $1,000 or $5,000 or $10,000 for your organization, and then they become a major donor. It really depends upon that behavioral data that you're collecting along the way.
Thanks. I think that's great, Tim. And I'd like to add to that that I think across all of the things that we've been talking about, it's important for people to take away that we really are, as Tim said, in a different place and in a different world. And it's changing daily, but it's never going to be back to the way it was. And that's exciting because we're all learning new things. But there are no hard and fast rules anymore in anything. And that's why this behavioral information is so important. And I do hope that, you know, you will download the presentation when we're done if you're listening, because there's really good information in here about what's important and which data points are important. And we've had a lot of questions about, you know, what data points would you say are the top ones? Well, I'm sure if I ask that to three people, we're going to get a lot of different answers, because it's really what's most important to your organization. If you're just starting out and you just starting to use personalization, that's going to be what's the most important for you. If you're more, you know, into more sophisticated types of analytics already, those are going to be different. So it really needs to be a conversation within your organization and talking to your peers within the community of fundraisers to find out how you can establish what's the best for your organization at this time.
Great. Thank you, everybody. Boy, when you tell Ellen to cut off at 58:30, she does. Exactly. We are just about out of time for today. On behalf of Fundraising Success and CDS Global, I want to thank everyone for attending, and I also want to thank Ellen, our moderator, as well as our panel. And I do want to remind you that you can use the login information that you used today to view this webinar on demand and to download it for the next 90 days beginning tomorrow. Be sure to check out our webinar page to get information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars. And also, if you would just take a minute to fill out the brief feedback survey that should be on your screen. That would be great. We'd be grateful for that. Your feedback will influence the webinars that we bring you in the future. Also, I hope to see you at the next Fundraising Success webinar. Thank you all so much.